Former Cabinet Minister Julian Smith tweeted that it is critical that the government is honest about the current situation and plays its part in stabilizing the markets. He claimed that No. 10 Downing Street can keep a growth plan but needs to make changes. Not doing so will only continue further stress and strain on UK citizens. Conservative MP Robert Largan was cited by The Guardian as saying that he has serious reservations about a number of announcements made by the Chancellor and that he does not believe that cutting the 45 pence top tax rate is the right decision when the government's fiscal room for manoeuvre is so limited. Mel Stride, the Tory chair of the Treasury Select Committee, urged the party to try to avoid a political crisis on top of an economic one, saying, "The question is whether the mini-budget plan is going to succeed. It's had an adverse reaction from the markets." The Guardian reported that in private remarks, some MPs went even further, slamming the mini-budget as a disaster and insisting that only a reversal of this financial package and the sacking of Kwasi Kwarteng could get the party back on an even keel. One MP told The Guardian, "Kwasi will have to go. Prime Minister Truss won't have any option. They're actually crashing the economy and she will need somebody to blame." Moreover, according to a YouGov opinion poll commissioned by the Times newspaper, Britain's Labour Party gained the highest level of citizen support over the ruling Conservative Party in the past 20 years, following the release of an economic growth plan by the government. On Friday, 23rd of September, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, unveiled a new £60 billion growth plan to support the country's economy amid rising cost of living. The plan includes cancelling the planned rise in corporation tax, keeping it the lowest in the G20 at 19%. Since the announcement, the yield on the United Kingdom's five-year government bonds has risen to its highest level since 2008 at 4.6%, which means a lower demand for British debt securities, triggering a barrage of criticism against Prime Minister Liz Truss and her government. The survey showed that the Labour Party is leading the Conservative by 17 percentage points. This is the highest level of support since Tony Blair, the first Labour Prime Minister, won the general election in 2001. There is opposition even among traditional Conservative supporters. Overall, the Conservative support fell by 4 percentage points to 28%, while Labour's support rose 5 percentage points to 45%. According to the opinion poll, 72% of respondents opposed the decision to reduce the maximum income tax rate to 40% for those who earn more than £150,000 a year. Meanwhile, 69% of respondents said they voted for the Conservatives in 2019. In addition, 71% of the public disagreed with the decision to lift restrictions on the payment of bonuses to bankers. Only 9% of those who voted believed that the measures outlined by Kwasi Kwarteng will improve their financial situation, and 25% believed that the government has a clear plan for managing the economy. In a separate development, The Guardian cited unnamed Whitehall sources as saying that Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng had a row over how to respond to the British pound plunging to an all-time low against the US dollar. According to the insiders, there was an argument between the two during the recent gathering, with the Prime Minister reportedly resisting the Chancellor's suggestion that a Treasury statement was needed to calm down the financial markets.
economic divide.
Ties between Russia and Iran have reached new highs. Between the two most sanctioned countries in the world, trade has reached an all-time high, and Iran recently hosted the biggest Russian delegation to ever come to Iran. What does this mean for the two countries? Well, that's obvious, but what it spells for the rest of the world, in particular Europe and the U.S., is that they could potentially lose out on the market of both countries, which between the two have considerable oil and gas reserves. Hello and welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, Russian delegation, 65 Russian companies, biggest trade delegation ever to visit Iran from Russia. Oil, automotive, and financial sectors were some of the companies that joined from those particular fields. Also, we will take a look at some of the recent Iran-Russia agreements, which has been in overdrive, like a gas swap deal, this automotive cooperation, and Iran and Russia will establish trade centers in order to help present the products that will be exchanged between the two. And another area of importance between these two countries is that, well, they are the sanctioned ones. They have ditched the dollar. They will cooperate on evading sanctions. And also, a new sanctions evasion corridor is in the works. As the crisis between Russia and the West continues to get worse, Russia is turning to alternative markets and business partners to counter sanctions imposed by the West on its allies. Iran, which is Russia's southern neighbor, is one of those partners. Tehran and Moscow have now decided to cement their trade and business ties, since both of them are targeted by cruel Western sanctions. As part of their expanding ties, a delegation from Russia has now visited Iran to boost ties. A delegation of 100 people representing 65 Russian companies has held 3 days of talks with Iranian counterparts in Tehran. The Russian delegation visiting Tehran was comprised of representatives from various companies, including manufacturers of food products, agricultural machinery, pharmaceuticals, and leading suppliers of communication equipment. More than 750 face-to-face meetings were held between Iranian and Russian businesses over the visit. Russia plans to dispatch at least 10 other business delegations to Iran until the end of this year. Members of provincial chambers of commerce from across Iran attended the planned meetings with the Russian delegation.
We produce technological machinery for different industries, including in the automotive sector. Today, we talked to several Iranian companies, and I am sure we will launch a joint venture with a number of them.
The sanctions cannot be a serious obstacle to business activities between us and Russians, because if there is a will to do business, there's a way. The U.S. measures can only complicate the payment channels for us, but we can do our transactions via our national currencies.
Iran's Ministry of Trade now says trade with Russia was in surplus for the first time in July through August amid a surge in sales of manufacturing products to Russian customers. The Islamic Republic of Iran Shipping Line Group, IRISL, has also reported a record high in its freight services between Russia and India through a newly launched corridor. It has shipped 27,520-foot-long containers, or the equivalent of 337,000 metric tons of cargo, between Russia and India in the 4 months to late July. When it comes to the online post about the topic at hand, obviously it's a big deal. But viewers saw it differently. They wanted to see where this was going to go in terms of the comments that they left, in terms of Iran and Russia, for example, being two countries that have been sanctioned heavily by the West, what this relationship is going to morph into. Let's find out what some of their thoughts are on this. First, Iran and Russia to establish trade centers. The two countries will focus on energy-related trading and establishing a north-south corridor to rival the Suez Canal. Next, Iran and Russia agree on the transit of 10 million tons of goods. The Russian side agreed to invest in establishing logistic hubs to increase transit capacity, especially in Shahid Rajai and Chabahar ports in southern Iran. Then came a viewer comment that really explained a whole lot, giving this another angle and depth. The whole threat of sanctions is now over, any other country that America will want to sanction will immediately receive overtures from BRICS countries to trade and prosper. America will become economically toothless and won't be able to continue to wage economic war. This is why Putin said that the sanctions are good. This is the beginning of the end of economic terror that the U.S. relied upon. They picked on the wrong country. Russia is not Venezuela, according to this particular reviewer anyways. Our final post here is about Russia and Iran, how they are looking to team up against what's called Western deception. That has been something that Iran's leader has said, where he has called for long-term cooperation between Iran and Russia. And he told the Russian President Vladimir Putin that the two countries needed to stay vigilant against what he called Western deception. Okay, Iran's leader, and a post that concerned him and his opinion on this. All right, let me introduce our guest for this program. We have Bijan Tavassoli join us. He's the Chief Executive Officer at MacGillegis, and he joins us to share with us his thoughts on this. Bijan Tavassoli, welcome to Economic Divide. Shortly after the Islamic Republic actually signed documents pertaining to its membership at the SCO, you had the announcement of this Russian delegation. Tell us why this is such a big deal.
Full membership of the largest regional organization will certainly increase and deepen Iran's ties with its most important neighbors. Russia and Iran have complementary strong points, particularly in the agricultural sector and regarding industrial output. Where they have strengths, such as in the petrochemical sector, both Iran and Russia are world leading in this sector and in the energy sector as a whole. There, I think they will certainly benefit from exchanging their experiences and skills, as well as from more coordination on the supply side, as they have previously already done with negotiations in the framework of OPEC Plus.
Okay, let's find out what Ahmad Abu Meri thinks. Ahmad Abu Meri is the head of external sales at Fingo, and he's an expert on international trade relations who's based in Moscow. Good to get a Russian side of things on this. Ahmad Abu Meri, welcome to Economic Divide. Taking a look at what has occurred over here, first of all, in terms of this delegation, obviously that's important. Lots of sectors covered between the two. But in the bigger picture, you have countries, Iran and Russia, who are now part of this, if you want to call it, grouping of countries that are part of the Eurasian Economic Union, for example, and also we're looking at BRICS countries. Tell us how this is going to impact trade globally and how it will take away trade from other countries like the U.S. and maybe the EU in terms of the union there.
Yes, of course. We now can see the huge business between Russia, China, and India in the gas and oil sectors. And in Iran also, we found a delegate from 60 different business sectors which visiting Iran. So the sanctions affecting the West and not countries which are under sanctions. And I am sure that soon we will see a front to force the West, and again we can see East Bloc and West Bloc.
Time now for our info news section of the program. There were lots of news from this past week. These are the ones that we picked. First up, we go to an issue that Germany is facing, and that is food shortages. What is going on there? German producers are warning of that. They can't cope with soaring energy costs, and because of that, they've issued that warning. Manufacturers are saying that this may soon force them to actually stop operations. Again, the EU powerhouse issuing a warning like that, somebody's got to listen. The EU needs to do something about that at a minimum. Next up, we go to what we found to be a really interesting piece of news because it has to deal with Islam and Muslims. And this particular piece of news is very interesting in terms of what they have done. Now, one in three Southeast Asian Muslims, they've actually turned out to be more devout than their parents, if you can believe that. That's based on a report that came out. Now, the resurgent religious faith and Western-style consumerism are the two factors that have actually transformed the consumer habits of the region's Muslims, according to the survey. This is particularly focused on the Asian side of where Muslims are inhabiting. So very interesting. We figured since this has to deal with Muslim consumer habits or buying habits, that we should highlight that. Next up, an issue that is not really talked about much or covered as much, and it's called dark money in the West Asia region and money lobbying. Dark money in money lobbying. Saudi lobbyist and ex-U.S. senator oversee millions in Republican campaign donations. That's right. Actually, this is not something that is new, but again, it's worth highlighting. This former U.S. senator has played a dual role of Saudi lobbyist and chair of the GOP super PAC. So you can see how dark money from the Saudi side is doing its thing when it comes to U.S. politicians. And then next up, we're going to take a look at the U.K. economy. Gosh, we have covered the U.K. economy so often in this program. But the newest, the new prime minister, not so new at this point really, is sending investors fleeing with historic tax cuts and borrowing. Liz Truss is now facing some heat on that. Meanwhile, Britain's new finance minister made that announcement and said it has unleashed historic tax cuts and huge increases in borrowing, which has affected businesses in that country. Those are the ones that we picked.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the in-depth section of the program. Now, this in-depth section is meant to show what happens when the new world order is taking shape and with two key players of that new world order and how they are elevating their trade status. Well, when they do that to considerable proportions, there's a large impact that happens as a result. For example, when it comes to exports between Russia and Iran. Well, the field is not really an even one. We could take a look at Russian exports. We went from the years 2016 through 17, all the way through 2021 and 2022. So Russian exports to be between $1.1 to $1.5 billion annually, except for the year 2017 and 2018. It peaked at $1.6 billion annually between 2021 to 2022. Meanwhile, Iran's exports risen conservatively from 2016-17 steadily. That figure has more than doubled over to over $560 million. So there you have how trade stood between the two. Now, a snapshot of the types of products that is being shipped is also worth taking a look at, since these areas are surely in areas that are going to grow. For example, food exports for both countries ranks at the top of the list. You're seeing 78% of Iranian exports to Russia. We took the year 2019 as a snapshot before COVID came. Chemical products at 7%. And then metals, 4%, plastic and rubbers, and other at 8%. Food products is a whopping 78%. So it leaves room for other categories to actually improve. Now, in the year 2020, there were about $1.5 billion in exports versus the $627 million in the trade balance compared to the year 2021, where exports stood at a little over $3 billion versus a little over $2 billion in the trade balance. So obviously a huge difference showing the rebound that has happened between the two countries in terms of their trade, and of course this graph displays that fully. And finally, given the transformation taking place for Russia to shift to the east, well, surely there's going to be countries that are going to be replaced based on what countries Russia did trade with because of the conflict that has happened in Ukraine and of course because of the sanctions. Here you have some of the countries that Russia has done trade with in terms of the top, we're looking at about 10 of them. China, of course, is going to remain at number one, but when you take a look at countries like Netherlands, Germany, maybe even South Korea or Italy, United Kingdom for sure, these numbers are going to reshuffle or they're going to go out the picture and have other countries replace that because the conflict in Ukraine and the sanctions as a result of it will mean that Russia will be looking for new trading partners where it can export its products to. Okay, time for an analysis. Let's have our guest rejoin us. First, we'll bring back the Chief Executive Officer at Maggie Legis, Bijan Tavassoli, who rejoins us. Bijan, the relationship between countries that are sanctioned by the U.S., such as Iran and Russia, well, they can overcome many problems, but tell us how things stand when the Americans think whatever country they impose sanctions on, that their trading activities is going to be stopped.
The illegal U.S. sanctions policy is having an effect quite contrary to that intended by the White House. In forcing more and more nations out of their Washington consensus, Western imperialists are driving those very nations closer together. The deep and enduring friendship between the people of Venezuela and Iran is just one example of that unlikely Western intervention. In sanctioning Russia, Washington has precluded any opportunity for Western European integration of the Russian Federation. They have forced Moscow policymakers to choose the only viable alternative pathway. Meanwhile, the relative lack of damages inflicted upon the Russian economy demonstrates that the specter of U.S. sanctions has lost much of its former coercive power. The future of the U.S. dollar as a global reserve currency and as an instrument of U.S. hegemony is now highly contingent upon developments that the Americans can no longer fully control.
Well, let's see what Ahmad Abumeri thinks. He rejoins us, head of the external cells in Plingo, and expert on international trade relations, who's based in Moscow. Ahmad, I'd like to elaborate more on how you have countries that are being sanctioned by the U.S. And in this case, the point, obviously, Russia and Iran are two of them, because the U.S. thinks that whatever country they impose sanctions on, that they can be stopped. However, we're looking at the fact that these countries like Iran, China, and Russia are proving that perception to be wrong. In what ways do you think that's happening, if you agree?
Okay, thank you for this question. This is a good question, by the way. So let me tell you that the BRICS are not weak countries. They are five of the strongest economy in the world. So when you talk about China and Russia, those countries have a self-safe chain. Then here are India, Brazil, South Africa. They are a very emerging economy, according to the International Monetary Fund. So in my mind, this is a big success, and the door is open for other countries to join. As we know now, Egypt, Algeria, and Iran, and other countries discussing the joining for BRICS. Finally, I would like to say that joining the BRICS is a big advance for any country, especially those countries which do not have enough energy, gas, and oil. And to keep in mind that the BRICS members are represent 40% of the world population and just over a quarter of global GDP.
Ties between Iran and Russia are set to expand even further after Iran gained full membership of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The SCO, which is made up of China, India, Pakistan, Russia, and the ex-Soviet Central Asian nations of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, was set up in 2001 as a political, economic, and security organization to rival Western institutions. Russia, along with China, are key players there. Iran's accession to the organization can further help Tehran and Moscow boost the trade ties.
We saw how popular Iran's products are, and there's vast potential for cooperation. Contrary to the assumptions that Iran can be isolated through sanctions and threats, we saw the enthusiasm of regional countries to engage with Iran.
Early in 2022, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi visited Moscow, which was described as a turning point in the ties between Russia and Iran. Back then, political, economic, energy, trade, and space issues were among topics discussed in Moscow. Iran and Russia are also trying to finalize a 20-year long-term partnership agreement, which will further increase their ties.
Relations between Russia and Iran are developing on all the vectors that have been formed in previous years. We are in the final stage of working on a new major treaty between Russia and Iran, which will mark the developing of relations at the level of a strategic partnership.
Iran is also joining the Eurasian Economic Union, which is an economic union of some post-Soviet states located in Eurasia. Russia is an important partner in that union. Iran's membership in that union will give Iran and Russia a greater chance to boost their bilateral ties. Iran has also applied for membership at the BRICS group of nations. There, ties between Iran and Russia will also get more enhanced, which includes trade and business ties.
The trade and economic relationship between Iran and Russia is in overdrive when it comes to the signing of agreements. Let's begin with one of the biggest ones between the two, a 20-year cooperation agreement. Iran and Russia are determined to update the 20-year cooperation treaty they had signed in 2001. The agreement was originally meant to last for 10 years, but it has twice been extended for 5 years. In bilateral relations, the two countries are determined to update the treaty on the basis of mutual relations and principles of cooperation between Iran and Russia in harmony with global developments. That's what the Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian has said. Then came the Russian investment of $40 billion in Iran's oil sector. This was announced during Russian President Vladimir Putin's visit to Iran and may have been motivated by U.S. sanctions. Russia will invest $40 billion in Iran's oil industry, building upon the $4 billion the Eurasian country has already invested in the sector. The move follows a cooperation agreement between the Russian companies, including the gas giant Gazprom and the Islamic Republic. To put things into perspective, Russia and Iran, the number one and two world's largest gas reserves, are best placed to coordinate the reserves and control prices. Russia has around 48 trillion cubic meters of gas reserves, while Iran possesses 38 trillion cubic meters. But the details of this massive agreement are multifaceted because it involves another major cooperation, a gas swap deal. First, Iran would soon purchase 9 million cubic meters of gas per day from Russia via Azerbaijan. The ministry also stated that it will soon receive 6 million cubic meters of gas per day from Russia as part of a swap agreement to export it in LNG, liquefied natural gas, to other countries from southern Iran. The agreement also calls for the completion of gas pipelines from Iran to Pakistan and Oman, as well as the completion of a number of LNG production projects in the country. The development of Iran's Kish and North Pars gas fields, as well as 6 oil fields, boosting pressure in the South Pars gas field, completion of LNG projects, swap of gas and petroleum products, and construction of gas transfer pipelines are among the highlights of the deal. That does it for this segment of the program.
The significance of this Russian delegation, which is the biggest one to ever come to the Islamic Republic, is huge. Aside from the fact that Russia and Iran are forging closer ties when it comes to trade and finance, what is big about this is that you have two super energy giants who are expanding their energy sales and also the way that they're going to transfer energy throughout the world. However, there's going to be two big losers on this, and that will be Europe and the U.S. Russia and Iran will definitely be looking for customers, especially Russia, based on the Ukraine conflict, to expand their trade in energy. Only time will tell how much of an increase that will be and how bad an impact that will have on Europe and the U.S. From Ikovit Atli and the team, looking forward to seeing you next week.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, a leaked report has shown that the Environment Agency knew that raw sewage was being dumped into English rivers as long ago as 2012. Stay with us as we look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more on this story. The Environment Agency knew raw sewage was being illegally dumped into English rivers from wastewater treatment works a decade ago, according to a new leaked report. However, the agency's chief executive told MPs back in May that the practice had only recently come to light. The Environment Agency's 2012 inspection report for the Northwest region shows that a number of sewage works belonging to the water company, United Utilities, were dumping raw sewage into rivers while failing to treat the required amount of sewage stipulated in their permits. Water companies are allowed to discharge untreated sewage into rivers, lakes, and seas only at times of exceptional rainfall, and only then if they are already treating a specified volume of sewage known as flow-to-full treatment. The report shows the United Utilities was fined £200,000 for flow-to-full treatment-related breaches at its Cletore sewage works in Cumbria, where flow data showed that only 65% of the required sewage was being treated while raw sewage was being dumped into the nearby river, and that the storm overflow where had been set deliberately to this lower level. It also shows Environment Agency officers suspected a further 35 United Utilities works to be dumping sewage while failing to treat the required amount of sewage. Officers carried out inspections at 9 sites and found issues with flow-to-full treatment at 5 works as a result of problems with flow meters and an Archimedes screw, along with erratic readings and gaps in flow data. Although the report was written in 2012, the Environment Agency Chief Executive Sir James Bevan told the House of Commons Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Committee in May of this year that until recently we have not had very good data about what is happening at sewage treatment works. Two investigations into the practice are underway. In November, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs announced that several water companies had come forward to say that many of their sewage treatment works may not be compliant, and that the Environment Agency and Ofwat had both launched sector-wide investigations into sewage dumping in English rivers. The Department for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs announcement came shortly after campaigners from Windrush Against Sewage Pollution published its analysis of water company data that showed many works were dumping raw sewage in dry conditions and without treating enough sewage. But Bevan told MPs in the House of Commons on the committee that it was the Environment Agency's insistence that water companies put monitors on their sewage treatment works that prompted water companies to come forward and tell the agency that the data would reveal non-compliance. And it was that understanding, which only came to us, frankly, within the last 12 months, that led to the investigation that the Environment Agency is running that appears to show significant and widespread breaches of permits, Bevan told MPs in the House of Commons. A whistleblower from the Environment Agency said the report highlights how common the practice is. This was known back in 2012 when self-regulation was pushed and water quality monitoring, staffing and regulation was dramatically cut. The Environment Agency had an opportunity to prevent over 10 years of illegal sewage dumping but chose not to take it, despite the funding being available. they knowingly permitted the illegal activity to continue to this day. An Environment Agency spokesperson said the agency has significantly driven up monitoring and transparency from water companies in recent years. In 2016, there were only 800 event duration monitors on storm overflows, and now there are more than 12,000. This data is allowing us to hold the industry to account on a scale never seen before. The BBC tells us more about the same story. Pollution warnings are in place for dozens of beaches in England and Wales after untreated sewage was discharged into the sea around the coast. Official data shows there have been a number of discharges since Monday, which Southern Water says are to protect homes and businesses. The pollution follows a period of heavy rain across southern England after a spell of extremely dry weather. Warnings from the Safer Seas and Rivers Service are based on water firms' data. The service is run by charity Surfers Against Sewage. Many of the beaches contaminated are popular resorts in England and Wales and include Bognor Regis in West Sussex, New Quay in Cornwall, East Lough in Cornwall, Heacham in Norfolk, Rest and Sandy Bay in Bridgend, Morecambe North in Lancashire, Cowes in the Isle of Wight, Robin Hood's Bay in North Yorkshire, Sidmouth Town in Devon, Shoreham Beach in West Sussex, and Southend-on-Sea in Essex. The majority are along England's southern coast. Near Bath is a popular swimming spot along the River Avon called Worley Weir, which runs through an area belonging to landowner Johnny Palmer. Untreated sewage has been released just upstream. Mr. Palmer has been working for years to make the water clean enough to gain bathing water status. I think it's a disgrace. You've got children swimming in that water and you know you can't tell your kids to not drink the water. So you've literally got children drinking sewage, which is the kind of thing you might expect in parts of Africa, but you know, Western Europe, but this is Western Europe, he said. Rivers are a central part of our landscape and our ecology and our natural environment. They are a resource that everyone can and should use and does use. Southern Water is one of the water companies responsible for those regions, along with Wessex Water and South West Water. In a statement, South West Water said, there were thunderstorms accompanied by heavy rain the night before last and on Tuesday. Storm releases were made to protect homes, schools and businesses from flooding. The release is 95% to 97% rainwater and so should not be described as raw sewage. We know customers do not like that the industry has to rely on these discharges to protect them, and we are pioneering a new approach. Last year, Southern Water was fined a record £90 million after admitting deliberately dumping vast amounts of sewage into the sea across England's south coast. Under European Union law, these kinds of sewage discharges are legal only in exceptional circumstances. They happen mostly after heavy rain, when there is a risk that pipes that carry stormwater along with sewage may overflow. However, in 2020 and 2021, there were almost 400,000 of such events.
It's true. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. Outside of these lectures, we have spoken a lot about the meaning of God's forgiveness, Ghufran. So what does forgiveness mean in this context? Forgiveness means to close the gap, to mend the tear and to heal the wound. This is Ghufran. How can this be achieved? How can this tear in the soul caused by a sin be mended? By making up for it. When someone drags their soul down from the heights of human ideals and causes it to sink to a lower level, they must do something to make up for this in order for their soul to rise again. Take another example. You get into a car and set off on a journey. Now, if the car breaks down on the way, what will happen to you? You'll be delayed. So how can you make up for this delay once you get it working again? By going a little faster, by denying yourself a little comfort, you can still arrive on time.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If you just sit there and say, oh no, what a mistake I made. Why didn't I set off sooner? Oh God, please forgive me. This won't be of any use to you. Yes, you made a mistake, but now you should make up for it. Go a little faster so that you reach your destination on time. God doesn't say that when you commit a sin, there is nothing you can do to efface it. He is not vindictive. Surely, I am the all-forgiver. The Quran, Surah 20, verse 82. Those sins you committed, those mistakes you made, all of these can be forgiven. If you are willing to make up for them, God does not say, because you made one mistake, no matter how hard you try, no matter what you do, you cannot be forgiven. No, surely I am the all-forgiver. I will forgive, I will heal you and make you whole again. But for what kind of person? For him who repents, becomes faithful and acts righteously and then follows guidance. The Quran, Surah 20, Verse 82. God says he will forgive the one who repents. And what is repentance? Tawbah? It means to come back. Your path to perfection was here, but you went that way instead. But you can be forgiven. When? When you come back to the path of perfection and follow the right way again. For him who repents, for him who comes back, who strengthens his faith and who acts righteously. One who acts.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. You've done
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Fake news about Kim Jong-un gets wall-to-wall coverage, but citizens of a key U.S. ally opposing a joint military exercise goes largely unnoticed, says Tim Sharrock, author, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Media Ignored Major Anti-U.S. Military Protest in South Korea. Stay tuned for more. In America these days, almost any information about North Korea, be it rumor, fake news, or just plain silly, becomes fodder for the mainstream media. From TMZ to The Guardian, reporters know there is an insatiable appetite for anything that puts Kim and his country in a bad or crazy light. But when it comes to South Korea, which hosts 28,500 American ground troops, and the Pentagon's largest military base outside of North America, U.S. media coverage is, shall we say, highly selective. That was made resoundingly clear on August 14th, when Seoul was the scene for the largest public demonstration in decades against the U.S. military presence in South Korea. Amazingly, not a word about the protest appeared in the U.S. media. That day, thousands of people chanting, "This land is not a U.S. war base," demonstrated against Ulchi Freedom Shield, the first large-scale military exercises between U.S. and South Korean forces since 2017. The protests were organized by the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, KCTU, South Korea's second-largest labor federation. They were joined by a range of progressive allies, including People's Solidarity for Participatory Democracy, PSPD, an influential citizens group founded in 1994. At a time when military tensions on the Korean Peninsula are escalating and there is no clue for inter-Korean dialogue, we are concerned that an aggressive, larger-scale military exercise will exacerbate the situation, PSPD declared, adding, "We once again urge the U.S. and ROK governments to suspend the ROK-U.S. joint military exercise and make efforts to create conditions for dialogue." At the demonstration, protesters took direct aim at the heart of U.S. policy in Korea, with signs that read, "No war rehearsal, no U.S., and no Korea-U.S.-Japan military cooperation." Outside of the Korean press, the only outlets to cover this massive showing against militarism were Iran's Press TV and China's CGTN, which provided extensive video of the mobilization. The single print story on the march appeared in Xinhua, China's daily wire service. Neither the New York Times or the Washington Post, which often set the pace for U.S. press coverage of Asia, deemed the demonstration newsworthy. Hypocrisy, yes. As we put in a sardonic tweet, every rumor, fake news, intelligence leak, or eyebrow twitch about Kim Jong-un and North Korea gets star treatment in the U.S. media. Yet, when thousands of South Koreans march in Seoul against U.S. ROK war games, not one peep. The contrast seemed to hit a nerve. By the weekend, nearly 6,000 Twitter users had liked the post and over 2,000 had retweeted it. The contradictions were evident on Twitter itself, as it often does with countries we are not supposed to think. It slapped a label on one of the posts about the demonstration urging users to stay informed because this tweet links to a media website. With that warning, Twitter was effectively delegitimizing the coverage of demonstration. To be fair, political rallies on the left and right are a common occurrence in South Korea. Obviously, editors and reporters must make choices about what to cover. But in a country where a majority of its citizens support the presence of U.S. forces and a U.S. general has operational control over their army in times of war, a rally of several thousand citizens openly calling for a U.S. troop withdrawal is certainly newsworthy. At the same time, the drills have been a hot topic for years. In 2018, with much of Washington opposed, they were downgraded to computerized simulations as a way to build trust. During the denuclearization talks between President Donald Trump and North Korean Chairman Kim Jong-un, those talks collapsed in 2019 primarily over Trump's refusal to lift U.S. sanctions in return for a partial shutdown of the North's nuclear infrastructure. This year, with North Korea regularly testing its long-range missiles, the new presidents in Washington and Seoul, Joe Biden and Yoon Suk-yeol, decided to resume their real-life exercises. The air, land, and sea drills, which in the past have mobilized around 50,000 South Korean and 17,500 U.S. troops, began on August 22nd and wound up on September 1st. Sadly, the discrepancies in coverage reflect old patterns going back to the early days of the Cold War. Editorial staffs of major U.S. newspapers and cable news shows and now Twitter's upstart crew are steeped in Cold War mythologies about the Korean War and largely reflect the viewpoint of Washington's national security community. Currently, both parties see in the North a determined and dangerous long-term foe, and in the South, a reluctant ally torn between loyalty to the United States regime and its expansive economic ties with China, America's new nemesis. In this world, there is little room for coverage of South Korean trade unionists, leftists, and progressives who stand against the American consensus. That mindset was recently on display at the Post when it praised South Koreans for electing Yoon, an inexperienced conservative hawk who said during his campaign that he might consider a preemptive strike on North Korea to protect peace on the peninsula. South Korea makes a welcome turn toward the U.S. just when it is really needed, the headline crowed. The Post editorial also took a nasty swipe at former President Moon Jae-in, parroting right-wing talking points that he had consciously played down North Korea's human rights record and balked at adding new batteries to the American THAAD missile deployment that has drawn Beijing's ire. For America's papers of record, the failure to cover South Korea's progressive left also reflects a failure of nerve. The KCTU and People's Solidarity that organized this month's anti-war demonstration have deep roots in the democratic movement of the late 1980s, when years of struggle culminated in the massive demonstrations of 1987 that forced the pro-U.S. generals who had ruled the South for 26 years to step aside. During that era, both the Times and the Post offered extensive and often outstanding coverage of dissidents and government repression. But in the recent years, they have been far more interested in covering North Korean defectors and warning the public repeatedly about a possible underground nuclear test than exploring the complex internal politics of South Korea. Ironically, these papers are better prepared now to cover Korea than any time in the past 40 years. Since 2020, they have built large bureaus in South Korea and relocated their Asian news hubs from Hong Kong to Seoul, giving them an opportunity for first-class coverage of perhaps the most dynamic country in Asia. Stephen Dunbar Johnson, the Times International President, recently told the Korea Joongang Daily, "Looking at a 5, 10, 20-year horizon, Seoul just feels like it's right in the middle of the action. But in this coverage, the opinions and views of all Koreans need to be heard. That is particularly true when dealing with an issue as critical as the U.S.-Korean alliance, which President Biden has called a linchpin of peace, stability, and prosperity, but many Koreans now view as a barrier to their country's future."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Palestinians held a mass rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds in the face of growing Israeli aggressions against the holy city. People shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries on Israel's crimes in Al-Quds. Tensions have been on the rise in recent weeks as extremist Israeli settlers and Israeli forces desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
"We're sending a clear message to the whole world that the Palestinian resistance and the Palestinian people are in a constant battle against the Israeli enemy and will not remain silent over aggressions against Al-Aqsa."
People from all walks of life gathered to express their support for resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks.
"People in Gaza are attending this rally to affirm our support and full backing for the Palestinian resistance. We believe that armed resistance is key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine."
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
"We are here to support Al-Aqsa Mosque because it's part of our faith, and we are willing to sacrifice our lives in order to protect it. Gaza will always defend Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to protect Al-Quds."
Occupied by Israeli regime forces in 1967, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom and justice.
"Palestinians say they will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy city of Al-Quds." Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Tehran has hosted the 5th conference in solidarity with the Palestinian children and the youth. The event is held every year on the occasion of the martyrdom of 12-year-old Palestinian Mohammed al-Dur and other martyrs of Palestinian children and the youth. The event highlights the ongoing plight of those